Blog Talk Radio.
Going to be a great movie Geeks United show tonight. We've been looking forward to this for a while. You could say a decade in the making tonight's show, because we are reviewing the decade in film three different ways. We're going to review the top 10 best movies, according to Chris, the top 10 most promising, or how would you characterize it, Jerry?
Directors I didn't talk about in the other show. How's that?
That's great.
You
and
like
then
that?
I'll be not really. And then I'll be reviewing the top 10 movie trends of the decade. So we got a packed show. A couple of things to start out with, though. Avatar will be the biggest movie of all time. It will probably be the first movie to gross $2 billion worldwide. Is this amazing? Did you have any sense that this could do this, guys?
It's weird because it's James Cameron, so I mean, you definitely expected big things from it. But no, I think anyone who expected that it would outsell they expected it would outsell Titanic is lying. Like, I don't think anyone really expected it to be quite that big. I mean, especially because Titanic was his last movie. I mean, I think the most people were hoping for was that it would be very successful, and among the biggest movies of the year, but. Of course, it would not be as big as Titanic. That was his other movie, and it's amazing that this guy accounts for like $4 billion in film just from like two
movies.
12
yeah.
years apart, by the way. Like, it's
yeah.
really, really incredible.
Well, it's at 1.6 worldwide right now. It's got to make 1.8 to beat Titanic. I think it'll do it in the next week and a half.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, just this weekend in international grosses, it did 125.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like that's just in 1 week. All it needs is another 200 million to break the record. Like, it does seem like a fait accompli at this point. Like,
still number one, fifth week in a row.
Yeah, and the last movie to hold number one for 5 weeks in a row was Titanic.
Yeah, so you know, whatever. You know, I mean, it's like. Regardless what you think about the movie, I mean, he's basically, you know, unstoppable at this point. Regardless of what happens at the Oscars, it doesn't really matter at this point. I mean,
no,
it really doesn't. I mean, he has the top two grosses of all time. You know, say what you will, you know, he doesn't care at this point. He's laughing all the way to the bank a million times over. He really doesn't
yeah.
care at this point.
I mean, Oscars aren't going to make him any money.
Yeah.
No.
He is the bank.
I mean, he really is. I mean, this guy basically, I mean, you know, years to come, they'll probably say this this whole move to 3D, and he's made the biggest 3D movie of all time. They're going to, you know, I'm sure there are already essays that already say this or articles that he saved the film, he saved Hollywood.
Yeah.
But that's coming in the next year.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to really, you know, no one is ever going to doubt him ever again. That won't happen.
Tonight.
I don't know. You
no,
doubt the fanboys.
No, the fanboys don't pay mortgages. They don't pay cocaine
yeah,
payments.
True.
All right? So, you know, no one cares about them at this point. I mean, they might have mocked it. Look, we all were. The first trailer, you know, it was like he made the Thundercats movie. The second trailer, wow, this looks promising. And when you go see it, regardless of where you stand about the story structure and all that, and that's debatable, and there's a good argument to be made for the pros and cons of this film, they can't deny the experience of watching it. It is something that none of us, at least in our generation and the generations after us, have felt. really, watching a film.
My family is watching it again right now.
Mm-hmm. Also, with fanboys are just such a slight piece of the pie. I mean, slight percentage of what this thing is gross.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a mass movie. This movie appeals to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no question. Tonight is the Golden Globes. And it might be a good show because Ricky Gervais is hosting, so it might be a little less embarrassing than previous shows, including this one. I brought a little clip to kind of get us revved up for the Globes. This is 1985. This is about 30 seconds of an opening number that Nell Carter did during the Golden Globes. I'm sorry, I can't play anymore. Is that the most awful thing you've ever heard?
Definitely will rank as one of the most.
Any song that includes Pat Morita, Elliot Gould, and Linda Evans, I mean, that really takes the cake. So, I mean, that's right up there with Rob Lowe and Snow White and the Oscars. I mean, it's real cringeworthy. But those are tonight, and I'm sure that I don't think there'll be many surprises. With who picks up the awards, except I think they'll lean more Avatar than Hurt Locker when
because they go for the thing that the Golden Globes do, they're more concerned with like box office than anything else, not critical.
Yeah, and nothing has made a bigger splash foreign than Avatar.
Yeah, here's the thing though. Didn't a couple of years ago when they had the writer's strike, Atonement win?
Did it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it might have won Best Picture Drama, and That did not make a lot of money. It's a great movie. I like that movie a lot, but it didn't make a lot of money. It's not something that, you know, I'd say, you know, try to finance at home with or anything, but yeah.
Also, upcoming, this real quick and then we'll get into our list. Upcoming on Wednesday night, we have Peter Biskind. For those out there that don't know who that is, he's an author of some of the most praised and controversial books about the film business.
Scandalous.
Yeah, in the past few years. Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, Down and Dirty Pictures. And his new one is a biography on Warren Beatty called Star, How Warren Beatty Seduced America, which Beatty's a fascinating figure in the world of film for several reasons. But this book has been getting a lot of press because primarily the scandal in the book. The number of women Biskind claims that Warren Beatty romanced. And we ask him about that.
Okay,
and do you want to hear
a question?
Yeah.
Because since we're not going to get to ask him about it, going on that basis, he slept with more women than probably Ron Jeremy and John Holmes combined. I don't really buy that number. Going on that number, he is like doing Lexington Steel like numbers. And I just don't buy it, you know?
Well, I don't quite buy it either. I mean, obviously, he's very popular.
Think about that, man. I mean, think about
it. Yeah, well, it would have to be a different woman every night over 40 years. But my main point to him was, what was the point of writing about that? And here's what he had to say. The elephant in the room when you think about Warren Beatty are his romantic exploits. And I know your book has gotten a lot of press for this aspect. What was the value in investigating this like you did? What does it express about him in a larger sense?
Well, I mean, I think his, you know, he was a victim. You know, he nurtured this image himself. First of all, it was true. I mean, there's a lot of truth in it. He did, you know, was very active, romantically speaking. But he also nurtured that image because it kept him in the gossip columns, and this was, you know, long before he was a big star. Mm. So it helped him, but I think, you know, he became so infamous for it that, you know, he got himself into a lot of hot water with Leslie Caron because she left her husband and she had two children, and it sort of turned against him, you know, that he was seen as a, you know, somebody who broke up families and broke up marriages. And then his reputation for you know, for being a Don Juan, overshadowed his reputation as a filmmaker. So I think you have to, you know, in order to understand the sort of problematic or the problems that or paradoxes that bedeviled him in the course of his career, you have to understand the cost, how much that cost him, that aspect of his life. And at the same time, he used a lot of his girlfriends in his movies. You know, he used Julie Christie a couple of times. He used Diane Keaton. He used Annette Bening. You know, he made movies with, and he used Leslie Caron. He made movies with these people he was going out with, and that, and you know, to some degree, for example, and that affected the movie. So to some degree, Reds reflects, the plot of Reds and the performances in Reds reflect his relationship with Diane Keaton. I think it would have been a different movie, possibly with a different actress. You know, he initially wanted Julie Christie for the role. So that's, you can't really understand Beatty, I think, without understanding that aspect of his life.
So we'll be talking about Warren Beatty with Peter Biskin on Wednesday, and also we'll have the screenwriter of Extraordinary Measures and another guest as well.
Well, that's really incredible how you did that cross-merchandising, how we got Warren Beatty's book and Leslie Caron's book in there.
That's right. That would have been a good back-to-back duo there.
That would have been, yeah.
All right. This past decade, a lot of distinctions that can be made about this past decade in film, and we're going to cover all of them tonight, starting with what were the best films of the decade? And for that, we're going to turn to Chris. Chris, you have your list of the top 10 best movies of the decade.
I do, although I would not call it the best movies. I would call it my favorite movies.
Right.
Thank you. Movie geeks
all know that there is a very big difference here, and this is a really, really hard thing to do, and it was really hard for me to do. I mean, like, you think 10 years, every year we put together a top 10 list, so that's hard to do some years.
Mm-hmm.
So some years
yeah.
there's 10, 15 movies. So over 10 years, you're talking about 150 really good movies, and you try and pare that down to 10 movies. It's really, really hard. I mean, it's like cutting the throat of some babies when you're crossing a few movies off that list. You know, I mean, like, very, very hard.
I did time for that, but okay.
Yeah, well, you know, Roman Polanski has done worse. So.
Yeah, no, I know. Now, let me ask before you start, Chris. Is there going to be Jamie? How do you want to do this? Can after he's done talking, can we chime in, or do you not want that? Okay,
yeah,
no, I'm just checking, you know, I just don't know.
Yeah, I do not have any clips, Chris, because I want to save time in the show, and I figured we'd have enough to say about each selection.
It's fine, and I'm not going to dwell on most of these movies. In fact, I'm more interested in your categories, Jimmy. A lot has been made of these top 10 lists and stuff, and I think most of the movies speak for themselves. So.
Well, I think whenever we make a list, I mean, the trends are historical. More than things that are close to my heart. But with you and Jerry, I mean, these are figures in film and films that are close to your heart, and that's how you choose them. So
right.
that's understandable.
The 10 that I was left with are the 10 that literally, if I had to go away to a desert island and take only movies from the last 10 years, I would not be able to leave these movies at home. You know, I mean, I would have to take them. And it is interesting when you make this list and you do finally get it pared down to about 10 or 15, you stare at that list and there's just like seven or eight movies where it's like, that I can't cross that off. Like, I can't cross that off.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I'm glad you've suffered for this list. That sounds great.
No, there really are. There are definitely movies that, you know, are not on this list that are favorites of mine. But, you know, I mean, some stuff had to go. So,
let's hear number 10.
Number 10, Martin Scorsese's The Aviator. This was my favorite Martin Scorsese movie of the decade. I mean, I love everything he makes. I love The Departed. But I think that The Aviator is just a more well-rounded film. It's a film that I go back to more often, and I get a lot more from every time I watch it. Whereas The Departed is always fun. The Aviator has a lot of themes about Americans and wealth and independence and things like that that really speak loudly to me. So
an obsession. I mean, it is a mirror to almost Fincher's Zodiac in a way that
That's
it deals
right.
with
yeah.
its obsession. And I think now the only thing I've really heard against The Aviator, and this movie would be on my top 10 of the decade too, would be, it's not a Scorsese, it doesn't feel like a Scorsese movie, but for me it feels completely like one. If you understand his love of movies, it's there.
Exactly. In some ways it feels more, you can feel his love of movies more when he's painting, you know, Cecil DeMille and Catherine Hepburn.
Too.
Yeah. You and Ava Gardner. I mean, you can tell that he loves these characters. And Howard Hughes. He, you know, I mean, of all the nasty stuff that's been said about Howard Hughes and all the horrible ways you could depict him and the sort of images we have of him, he doesn't paint him that way. He paints him as a hero. I mean, he's in love with the man.
And it's a real grown-up performance by DiCaprio. I mean, it's a shining performance for him.
This the first time I really took a look at him.
Yeah, just the last scene where he, you know, where he's, you know, starts repeating the same thing over and over again. I found that it's just tragically haunting to watch. And I agree. I mean, yeah, it's you know, because you got the other depiction of Hughes that we're familiar with is from a James Bond movie of all films, Diamonds Are Forever, Willard White, you know, which is a very comical, you know, performance. So this is like this thing that rectifies that and puts Hughes in the proper perspective, I think.
Yeah.
Ironically, we're going to be talking about Howard Hughes a lot more on Wednesday night because that's the last great passion project of Warren Beatty, is Howard Hughes' story.
Yeah, he tried to get that done for a long time.
A long time. Okay, that's a great choice. And you're number nine.
All right, my number nine, you will probably not agree, Jamie, but it is the Royal Tenenbaums.
Dude, I love you.
It's hard to pick a Wes Anderson movie, but this was really, I mean, Rushmore obviously was the last decade, so that can't be chosen. But Royal Tenenbaums really feels like a classic more and more when I watch it. Mm-hmm. To me, this really, like, and a lot of people make comparisons to Harold and Maude and, of course, all Hal Ashby's films. I don't really see that so much anymore, and I never really did. But this movie feels, probably more than all the movies on my list, like a new classic for me, like something that I will never get sick of. I can watch it anytime. It makes me happy just to put the movie in. Every performance is firing on all comedic cylinders. Like, there's so much to be mined from this movie comedically through repeated viewings that I just never get sick of watching it.
I know you like Wes Anderson.
We love Wes Anderson.
What does this movie have over his other works?
Well, this was the first real big ensemble piece. Before this, he had made his first movie, Bottle Rocket. Then there was Rushmore. Now, they were all ensemble pieces, but they were sort of smaller ensemble pieces. There was about three to five characters most. I mean, this movie's got about 10 characters, and you fall in love with every single one of them. It really feels like this family that you get to know and you're rooting for everybody, and you just understand. It's the same way that you hate and love the people in your own family so much, like, oh, you fucking idiot, what are you doing, you know? You just, I really get that from this movie.
Totally.
And it's one of the last great Hackman performances, right? I mean,
it should be the retirement film.
Yeah. It would be a lot better than Mooseport, yeah. Which isn't making anyone's
I didn't say it, folks. I didn't say it. Jamie said it. So just remember that when you.
I love him in Heist. So Heist and Royal Tenenbaums.
Heist is technically before that. So.
Right, but that duo, that's a good way to end the career, I think.
Yeah. That and a bunch of Lowe's commercials.
Yeah. That's right. That's a good choice. I do not disagree. I think
Can I ask a question, Jamie? Because I don't. You know, I'm not in Florida. Is this something that you have to have sparred about in the past?
No, I don't say his choice is irrelevant. I just don't necessarily get the tone of Wes Anderson myself. It doesn't reach me.
How so? I'm just curious. I just want to know.
In the same sense that the tone of Up in the Air didn't reach me. It seems too mannered for me.
Oh, well, that goddamn Oscar host is going to crucify you for that one.
Oh, it only took you 13 minutes. That's awesome.
But I didn't name the name.
You didn't name the name.
So. Dude, I'm playing right into your hand there.
All right. Number eight, Chris, what is it?
All right, number eight's the heartbreaker on the list. Is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh, man. The movie's three for three.
The movie just, like, reaches into my chest like the villain in the second Indiana Jones movie and rips out my beating heart every time I watch it. And every time I watch it, I always forget what's going to happen. It's one of those movies that I don't really remember the plot of. Like, even now, I don't think I could describe, you know, not the plot, but the storyline to you.
Mm-hmm.
It always seems like a surprise every time I watch it. I feel like I've had my mind erased by the end of the movie because I'm so emotionally distraught by this relationship that has, you know, had these ups and downs. And it really, I mean, I always liked Jim Carrey. I even like Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber and stupid shit like that. But
not like here, though.
Right. This was the first time when it was like, whoa, I mean, this guy's really capable of being a great actor. He hasn't really ever done it since then, either.
No, that's the thing. He hasn't. That's the sad thing.
Yeah. But the movie, it will all. That's why I will always be interested in anything that Michel Gondry does from this point on, even though also, in his case, I haven't really been blown away by anything he's done since then. It's unforgettable, this movie. I mean, I can't.
What surprises me about it, because when you see Kaufman's name attached to anything,
yeah,
you think you know that it'll be clever and original,
yeah,
and unique, and kind of a mind warper. What surprised me about this one was its heart. You know.
Oh, it has a lot of heart. It's like the kind of film. I mean, this process, you know, it's funny. We all, at certain points in our lives, we wish that there was this place to go to where have this done. I'm certainly sure Tom Hansen in 500 Days of Summer wishes there are times that he could have had this done for many of his girlfriends before and after summer. But it's a universal film.
I love 500 Days. 500 Days is a great movie, but I think it owes a lot to Eternal Sunshine.
It owes a lot to a couple, but definitely this one. You're absolutely right, Chris.
They both, and especially Eternal Sunshine, touches on the way, not the big stuff, but those tiny little details in relationships,
mm-hmm,
stick in your
mm-hmm
mind. The little stuff that lingers in your brain that you can't get out of.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you grab that, walk through the supermarket and see that particular type of juice that she used to insist on buying or whatever,
mm-hmm,
the little detail is, it just drives you crazy because you can't ever stop relating that to her, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any movie that grasps that concept as well as Eternal Sunshine.
I agree. You're number 7.
Speaking of memory erasing, Memento.
Yeah, exactly.
What an excitement! What an exciting movie this was when it came out. Like, I mean, do you remember the buzz around it? People were talking about it. You know,
right?
This movie that's told backwards and stuff like that. But again, this is one that you get more and more of out of every time you watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I watch it. I used to think that, oh, it would be a better movie if they just told it straightforward, but I don't think it would. I mean, it is a gimmick. It's the same way that Blair Witch has a gimmick working for it, or
mm-hmm,
Paranormal Activity has this gimmick working for it. This movie is just a thriller that has this gimmick in it. But the gimmick works so well, and the beauty part about this gimmick is it's never going to be repeated in the way that Blair Witch, you can apply that gimmick to Cloverfield or, you know, Friday the 13th movie. This gimmick is so unique to this movie, and the story, again, this story is not much. It's a guy who's looking for the people who killed his wife. But with that one special touch that Chris Nolan adds, which is, you know, the mystique of telling it backwards, which works so well against all odds.
Do you don't think it would have worked as well if it was told chronologically?
No, absolutely
not. No, not at all.
No, I mean, I'm not saying it would not be a good movie. It probably was. It's directed by Chris Nolan. It's an interesting story, although not that interesting. It's got some great performances in it. But I do think it's essential that the movie is told, and it's kind of a misconception to say that it's told backwards. It's told piece by piece backwards. It's sort of overlapping.
Right.
It's not just backwards. It overlaps segments backwards.
Can I...
So that's interesting how the way it'll connect something that happened 20 minutes ago in the film but is really happening 2 seconds from now in the chronological timeline of the movie.
Can I
ask
you that?
Please.
No, it's not told backwards realistically. It's told
right,
the way most people's minds work. We don't we don't remember everything, or we don't piece together everything in this nice, you know, three-act story structure. We do it very sporadically, very stream of conscious, very broken up. And that's why Memento, I think, works. That's why Irreversible works, for that matter, too. That's how we think. And it happened in this past decade that just ended. We had filmmakers say, wait a second. Well, while it's all great to teach this three-act structure and screenwriting classes, this isn't how most people work in the real world. It's much different. It's very messy.
Right.
And that's what's beautiful about Memento. Life is messy. It doesn't conform to these methods. So
And yet, it's still a three-act structure.
Well, it's still
it just found a different way to do it.
Robert McKee is going to advocate at the end of the
day,
though.
Right.
I'm sorry, I should have specified that before I started talking.
No, it is interesting because you take all these innovative films with innovative structures, and essentially, no matter how they jumble them, they still work because they have a beginning, middle, and end. I mean, they have to. You have a movie is an emotional journey, and there has to be a journey represented to go on it. That's a good choice. Number six for you, Chris.
Number six for me, I can't really defend it, but it's Punch Drunk Love. I don't really know why this movie is stuck with me the way it is, and I realize that I'm, even among filmgoers, you know, a movie like Memento, you walk up to 9 out of 10 people on the street, they're not going to really remember much about Memento. They might remember it, but wouldn't remember much about it. Nobody remembers Punch Drunk Love, especially Adam Sandler fans. Like, they don't really like it. They think it was that one shitty art movie that he did. Mm. But this movie's always stuck with me in a way that I can't really let it go, and this is my list, so it's on there.
It has to be on your list.
That film is so perfect. It's a heartbreaker, and to me, I mean, it's not my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film. My favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film is Boogie Nights. But that was in the last decade. We're talking about this decade. And There Will Be Blood is not on my top 10, and that's not because I don't love it. If I had a top 20, There Will Be Blood is one of those movies that I had a hard time, you know, paring down, but eventually it got pushed to the top 20. But I couldn't do that to Punch Drunk Love because it's just stuck with me in a way that I can't let go. And like I said, I can't really defend it. It's just a really sweet, ultra-simple love story.
I think it's a magical thing that you can't articulate. It's kind of what McCabe is for me.
Yep.
I mean, you feel it. I mean, you, describing it would kind of lessen that.
Right.
In a way.
And there's not much to describe with the movie. I mean, it's really it's ultra simplistic, the storytelling. I mean, it's really childlike. There is no real story going on here.
But describing what you respond to in it.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree.
Would kind of wreck the mystique of it, yeah. What were you going to say, Jerry?
Can I defend it? I'll defend it for you, Chris.
Please do.
It's perfect. First of all, it's the best date movie ever made. Secondly, I don't think I've ever seen a more accurate depiction of loneliness put on screen.
Very true.
Also, the scene in the restroom at the restaurant is perfect. And also the scene where he breaks the sister's sliding glass doors. This guy is so angry.
Yeah.
So fucking angry. He's just has all this anger bottled up in him. I mean, think about what his job is. He makes plungers. His job is he makes the tool to push the shit down the toilet. He has to deal with so much shit in his life that this tool, this magical tool that will make your toilet work, there's so much beautiful symbolism in this film, but it's that he triumphs. And the sad thing is that the Adam Sandler fan doesn't know about this film. And the sad thing is, because they don't know about this film, it didn't do well. And it didn't do well, and this is where I get this whole argument a couple months ago. We typecast our actors. They want bedtime stories. They don't want Punch Drunk Love, and we are the lesser for that. We're the losers.
Well, I think you're right, and it's not just the audience that feels that way. I don't think Adam Sandler thinks too fondly of this movie. And you did put it better there than I ever could have. I mean, the movie's about loneliness, and no one listening to this show or not listening to this show has not felt that extreme, loneliness and angriness, and this is a story of a guy who is coming to the end of that feeling in his life.
Yeah.
He's not going to feel that anymore. And that's what's so beautiful about it is it's one of these movies where everything is okay in the end, but the movie brings me to tears every time I watch it because it's so sweet and so lovely. And nobody could have made that movie but Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right.
And plus it's a great combo of Sandler with – it's Emily Watson. Is it Emily Watson?
Yeah, that's right.
Perfect in this.
Yeah. And Sandler's never been better. So I don't know what else I can say about it, but I love the movie.
Number five,
Spike Jonze adaptation.
Ooh, you're so, picking a whole winners.
Talking about Robert McKee again. I think this is actually Charlie Kaufman's best script that he's written. I mean, I really do. Like, and that's, as I looked at this list of top ten, there's no links between any of the movies. There's no two movies by any one director. The only link is that there are two Charlie Kaufman scripts here. And I do think he's the scriptwriter of the last 10 years, not because of anything thematically that he's doing, just because he's got, you know, some really great work in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
This movie did a lot of things. It reminded me that Nicolas Cage was fucking awesome again. It was exciting. It's one of those movies that literally has everything. It's funny. It's scary at times. It's dramatic. It's got action in it. It literally has everything. All the performances are top-notch. And Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman, they're going to go off, and they have gone off and done things independently. But those two are magical together. Like, they really were born to work with each other. So, and maybe this is the last time we'll ever see that. So,
I love movies where you can see the process in the finished product.
Yes. Yes.
And this movie embodies that because he was hired to do something. He was struggling through it. He couldn't do it, and so he made a movie about that struggle, and he expressed a lot of other things within that. So it's an ingenious movie. Of course, but it's not ingenious in a way that so many movies that I find ingenious are, that distance you from what's happening. It's very involving. Nicolas Cage is, you're right, it's a wonder. You're like, man, why can't you spend your career doing this? You've got the goods. You know, it's like you're Marlon Brando, except you're actually accepting jobs, you know? you're wasting your talent by acting in a lot of these films, you know, by saying...
Again, the actor playing twin brothers or playing two characters in one movie was a gimmick that we had at this point. It was original when we first saw it, you know, in the 80s or whatever it was. But by this point, when this movie was made in 2002 or 2003 or whatever it was, that premise, that gimmick was fucked out. Like, we were no longer impressed by an actor playing two characters in the same movie.
Right.
But he impressed me again.
Oh,
he
wants
to be. And you're gonna see that with Edward Norton in this Leaves of Grass, too. I mean, this.
Think so?
You're going to see just how unique Nicolas Cage and the script for adaptation is.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Exciting.
You're number four, Chris.
Number four. The crime movie of the decade. You know I can't have a list without this movie. Sexy Beast. Jonathan Pryce's Sexy Beast. I mean, this movie, more than any other movie on the list, more than Royal Tenenbaums, more than Memento, this one gets better with every watching.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these movies are not ranked of mine. There's no number 10, number 9. They're literally random. I threw them on there in an order that was somewhat random, but this is not... The last one I say will not be the best one, so it should not be said that this is the fourth best movie of the decade. It's just number 4 on my list. They're random.
Okay. Favorite part.
Yeah. I just don't know how to quantify the properties of my favorite movies like that. I can't battle these babies against each other. So, but back to Sexy Beast. I used to, when the movie first came out, all the buzz was around Don Logan. It was all around Ben Kingsley's character. So when I watched the movie, the rest of it sort of melted away, and I was just sort of blown away by Ben Kingsley's performance. Over the years, the movie itself has become the beauty, and his performance is just the negative side of that beauty. Like, his is the ugly underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Ben Kingsley says it best on the commentary for the movie. He says, it's about a man who thought he was happy, so God sent him the most unhappy man in the world. And it can't be said better than that.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. The crime movie of the decade for me.
I watched it again today before we started the show.
Really? Really?
Oh, yeah. It's a favorite of mine, not just because of Don Logan. I mean, you know what? A lot of people always say that Ben Kingsley's playing against type in the film, and while that's very true, Ray Winstone is playing against type, too, because he always plays
exactly.
the heavy and Nil by Mouth, and the and there's some other films. He always played that, like, the tough British, you know, gangster and no remorse, or and he's, you know, he's a teddy bear in this movie. Let's be honest. I mean, or, you know, compared to what, you know, even what comes after, he's really a nice guy in this film compared to anything he's ever played before and after. But who's also very good is Ian McShane.
Oh, yeah, Teddy.
I mean, that
Teddy,
scene
Teddy
where Fox says, "I'm staring at the back of your head," and he says, "Well, why don't you stare at the back of your own
back of your own fucking head?"
Yeah. That's great.
Yes, very quotable movie too.
Mm-hmm.
Like one. Movies can be their greatness can be quantified in some ways about how quotable they are.
Yeah.
You know, Real Genius is insanely quotable. Ghostbusters
yes,
is insanely quotable. Sexy Beast is insanely quotable.
Mm-hmm.
So many great lines from this movie. I'm not going to go into them here, but fans of the movie. And Jamie, again, I know you. This is not one of your. Probably wouldn't show up on your 10 best of the decade list. Probably wouldn't show up on a lot of people's. But
it showed up on mine when we did this back in August. But yeah.
Really?
I've seen it on a lot of top 10 decade of the list. There's a ferocity and an energy to it that I find really special.
Yeah.
I tend to choose movies that only. Reduce me to a pool of tears.
Beast reduces me to a pool of tears. Okay,
that's my own sensibility, but I don't argue with the choice. Certainly not. You're number three, Chris.
Number three, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's Amélie.
Yeah,
yeah.
Probably the only. In fact, it is. I think the only foreign film on my list. Not to say it's not the only good foreign film of the last 10 years, but. Just a completely original piece of work, so unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the performance, but just the story, just the journey that she takes, all the imagination that went into this script, all the beautiful cinematography, all the colors. It's a lot like Avatar in a strange way. It's a real experience sitting through this movie. I mean, you can't passively put this on and you know, watch it while you're doing something else. First of all, because it's in another language, and you wouldn't understand it if you weren't looking at the screen. But you can't passively sit and watch it either. It's just not a movie. I mean, it's a movie that demands your attention. So, and again, one that nothing too fancy here, nothing too special as far as the story goes. You know, it's a girl who's looking for love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the execution. That was so special and unforgettable, in my opinion.
You know, when you remember movies, it's not the story that you remember. It's moments, you know?
Yeah. And it's an overall feeling, too.
Can I ask a question? Chris, have you been over my house watching the movies that I've been watching the last 2 months?
Well, Jerry, I think you and I, in a lot of ways, the three of us overlap on a lot of stuff, but I do think that if two of us were closer in this group of three, it's probably you and I as opposed to me and Jamie or you and Jamie.
Yeah, no, because I watched...
Nothing against Jamie. It's nothing against
No,
Jamie.
Nothing. No, Jamie has very good taste, but I'm just saying because I watched this, I wanted my mom had never seen this, you know, and because she doesn't get to leave the house that often before I moved back home, and I wanted her to see this, and she fell in love with it, and I'd watched this in December again. I hadn't seen it in a while, and that's true with Eternal Sunshine and everything that you've actually brought up on this list so far. I've actually watched again in the last month. But this and what I think is really special is the soundtrack.
Mm.
I can't get
yes.
the music out of my mind.
Yeah,
I've never been able to.
Yeah. Yeah, and also Amélie also gets the award for movie that I've tried to get the most people to watch with the fewest success stories.
Really? I mean, you're the first person I heard about the movie from, Chris.
Oh, is that right? Is that right?
Yeah, actually, yeah. I borrowed the DVD from you, so I'm one of those
Shit.
People.
Well,
okay.
You were one of the few who did watch it.
Right.
All right. Number two.
You're number two.
We might stray on our paths here, Jerry, but number two on my list is O Brother, Where Art Thou? I think it's the singular... The singular achievement of the Coen brothers in the last 10 years. I don't think it's necessarily their best film. I definitely love Miller's Crossing. I definitely love The Big Lebowski, Fargo. But of the last 10 years, which were weaker than their first 10 years, arguably, O Brother, Where Art Thou is the best for me.
More than Man Who Wasn't There.
Yeah, and I love The Man Who Wasn't There.
More than No Country for Old Men?
Yes. Again, those two movies, like There Will Be Blood, I love very much. And I probably love The Man Who Wasn't There more than No Country for Old Men, simply because No Country for Old Men was just a great book. And the book was so close to the movie that, in a strange way, I really don't feel like the Coen brothers did very much there. Like they did a great adaptation, but it wasn't an achievement on their part so much as I feel like it was an achievement on the part of Cormac McCarthy.
Right.
But Man Who Wasn't There, but especially Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, is so unique, and also, in a way, an adaptation. I don't know. The music, of course, the soundtrack was like the biggest soundtrack of the decade.
The movie was their biggest success, I think. Even though it wasn't in the top 10, it stayed around for the longest of all their films, I think.
Yeah, it had extreme legs on it. It's insanely watchable. It's just a really sweet, good-hearted movie. I mean, you're not going to feel yucky after you watch it. You're not going like go take a Silkwood shower or anything after you watch this movie. You just enjoy the music. This is the first time I realized that George Clooney was fucking hilarious. You know, the look of the movie, the soundtrack, the performances, the story, the humor, everything, firing on all cylinders. And
you're right.
And also appealed to so many different groups. This is a movie that's for literally for everyone. Like, there's no group of people who can't watch this movie and get something out of it. You know, old people, young people, white people, black people, men, women. Everyone likes this movie.
No, it's their biggest. It's actually, I do think, more so I think than No Country for Old Men, it is their most popular movie, especially because of the soundtrack. People really reacted favorably to the soundtrack. So,
yeah, and introduced T-Bone to the movie public.
Yeah.
You know, and he's in the news again this year for Crazy Heart. So.
Yeah. Strangely, I don't like to listen to the soundtrack because it just makes me want to watch the movie. So if I want to listen to the soundtrack, I just watch the movie.
And plus, so many people in the Sparrow Fart Town where we live are already listening to the soundtrack in their cars. So,
All right,
your number one, Chris. I wish I had a drum roll, but here we go.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind though. Actually, I said there is no ranking to this list, but this one probably would be my number. If I had to choose my favorite of the decade, I wouldn't be able to number 1 through 10, but number 1 I would probably be able to say definitely would be the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And it is the trilogy, and I'll tell you why. And I know some people would say that's kind of a cheat because they're three separate movies, but for me, they're one movie because I never, ever, 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 ever watch them singly. If I get a hankering to watch The Lord of the Rings, I start with the first one, and I watch all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I never watch them unless I've got the day off. Like, you will not find me watching. I mean, it's an 11-hour endeavor for me to watch The Lord of the Rings. I'm either going to watch them all three, or I'm not going to watch them. I'm going to watch Punch Drunk Love or something like that. So,
right.
This was the trilogy of the decade. It was the sci-fi epic of the decade, maybe. Time will tell. And I think it's the trilogy. I used to think that Star Wars was the greatest trilogy of all time. Untrue.
Pissed on all that, so.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. And even if he hadn't, I really do think that the Star Wars movies started out good, got great, and then went back to good.
Yeah.
The Lord of the Rings movies were
got good. Better and better.
Better, best. They just to sit and watch this for 11 hours is such a thrill because it's like it's that three act structure we were talking about. But
and without a doubt, yeah. Without a doubt, it's one of the most, or if not the most staggering achievement of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at that material and the mountain he had to climb, it seems so insurmountable. And the fact that he did it, the fact that New Line bet on it, and now New Line has gone bye-bye, but it amazes me. It was a major risk undertaking that movie, and that it paid off was a miracle and a major testament to the talents of Jackson.
Let me ask Chris the question here, though. Do you think it's the greatest cinematic trilogy of all time?
Um, Yeah, there isn't another one that rushes to mind.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm with you.
To be perfectly honest with you, I mean, really, the trilogies, you're really only talking about, you know, sci-fi and action adventure movies. That's the only movies where you really get trilogies.
Or Godfather.
Well, yeah. But again, does anyone really put that one into the conversation when you're talking about trilogies?
No.
They put it with things, but okay. We're not going to go there right now.
They'd like to pretend it's not a trilogy.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if we're talking about best set of two, Godfather is in the conversation, ironically. But as trilogies go, no, I don't think there's anything better. I don't think there's going to be for a long time.
No, I don't. I think this is it. This is the be-all, end-all.
That's a great list, and we're running right on time, so we're doing good. Chris's list of the best of the decade, Avatar. The Aviator. It looks like Avatar when you just glance at it. The Aviator, The Royal Tenenbaums, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Memento, Punch Drunk Love, Adaptation, Sexy Beast, Amelie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and The Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's his top ten of the decade.
Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
That's the best top ten of the decade, and I mean that. I've looking over so many lists, that's my favorite one.
Oh, thank you. You really hit on a lot of films
that I really mean a lot to me personally.
Oh, well, they mean a lot to me. Those are special movies to me, truly.
I don't know how you did that, because, I mean, obviously it was me, and there would be like 20,000 footnotes. But, but no, Chris, really, that's a really awesome list. That's a beautiful list. I'll just say
right now. Great list, dude.
Yeah.
All right, Jerry, it's time for your top 10 list.
Okay, you're going to cut me off at 10, right? You're going to, because you know how to count, right, in the English language, James?
Yeah.
You do know how to do that. Good. Okay. You know, I didn't get to talk about this guy because I forgot to mention him on the other show that I do. Wong Kar-wai, number 10, for In the Mood for Love, 2046. He did one of the films in Eros, and he did his American debut, My Blueberry Nights, which, if anyone's keeping track at home, has Rachel Weisz and Natalie Portman, and you can shut the hell up after that.
I like that movie.
That's a good movie. Isn't that a good movie?
Yeah, it is.
That's an awesome movie. But In the Mood for Love is really the one that I'm talking about in as far as this decade goes. But it's very important to know that whatever the company was that owns the rights to his films released the older films of his. I had watched in the last decade, like a lot of people, I'd watched Chungking Express that Quentin Tarantino gives the introduction on beforehand. And that's a very good movie. And I watched Happy Together, but it was hard to watch a lot of his films because they weren't available. And then Days of Being Wild and all these other films became available in this decade, and I fell in love with him. And he makes beautiful films. And In the Mood for Love is one of two films that I've seen in the first half of this decade that really cinematically describe what love is. And it's an incredible film. And just he just evokes this old Hollywood charm and glamour that I haven't seen from a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to be mentioned. He's incredible.
Well, I am ashamed to say I have seen 2046 and I loved it. I did see My Blueberry Nights and I loved it. I haven't seen In the Mood for Love, which is the masterpiece.
We're not. It's not a contest. It's not a race. That's cool. I mean, I hope you.
No, I'm personally ashamed because I very much have wanted to see it.
It's his
masterpiece.
It's a beautiful film. I saw it. I left work one day early to go see it, and I remember a guy fell asleep near me, and he was snoring, and his girlfriend was like, "Oh, don't wake him up. He works all the time. Please don't wake him up." But it's a beautiful film. I mean, I think the cinematographer he likes to use a lot, Chris Doyle, who has just a great eye for everything, and he's done a lot of wonderful films, and he just has a great eye. I mean, they're just wonderful films.
Well, and his eye is what I like about Lady in the Water. When I talk about how well shot Lady in the Water is,
mm-hmm.
it's Chris Doyle.
Oh, yeah. I don't deny, I'm not going to deny you there. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So just to bring everyone up to speed, we've gone through the top 10 of the decade with Chris. Now we're going through 10 directors of distinction from the past decade with Jerry. Okay, your next choice, Jerry.
And this is going to piss you off, Jamie, like you've never been off before.
Jody Hill, The Foot Fist Way, and Observe and Report.
Okay.
Yeah. I watched The Foot Fist Way again today because I knew that I would cause trouble later on. And Observe and Report is not the obvious choice you would, you know. I know, Jamie, you don't like it, and that's not why I picked it, because you didn't like it, but it left a distinct mark on me. But while doing the other show that I do with Francis, Paul Bassetti had brought up it reminded him a lot of Punch Drunk Love. And that's the most intelligent analogy I've heard about the film, the comparing Adam Sandler's Barry Egan to Seth Rogen's character in the film. But that's beside the point. Jody Hill is a sick son of a bitch. And if you watch The Foot Fist Way and Observe and Report, this guy has just a great comic timing. He works with Danny McBride, obviously, in the first film, and then works with Seth Rogen. But he has a way of getting out these really dark, perverted performances, but actually making a really good film in the process. And I think he's a talent to watch in the next decade. I don't think he has anything lined up off the bat. I was doing some research earlier. But these two films are great character studies. Besides being insanely funny, in the Observer Report's case, I like to throw in the fact that there are two other black comedies, World's Greatest Dad and Big Fam, which I finally watched yesterday. And while I like those films, I still think Observer Report is just so disturbing in many facets that it works. So Jody Hill was my number 9.
Black comedy is tough.
Oh, it's too. It's impossible. Yeah. Try watching Big Fan with my dad, okay?
Well, it's obviously got to be very dark and disturbing, and yet it has to deliver the laughs on some level. So it's a delicate balance.
I know
balance.
You did not like Observer Report. You had a lot of problems with it.
I didn't like Observer Report, but because it was missing the laughs for me. But
no,
I'm not familiar with Jody Hill, really career-wise. So I can't say one way or another, but it means something to you. That's why it's on
your list. It means, dude. I just cut me off when we get to 10 because I don't know how to count. Okay, just
okay. So your next choice,
Ryan Johnson, Rick and the Brothers Bloom. I have watched both of these films again in the last month. I don't know what Looper, his third film, promises to be, but watching Brick in December again. When Joseph Gordon-Levitt and his co-stars recite that language, when they incorporate Johnson's words, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a linguistic ecstasy that I haven't only heard one other time this decade. Watching The Brothers Bloom again last night, I don't know. That you know, I wish that Inglourious Basterds and the other two films, 500 Days of Summer, Adventureland, hadn't come out this year. It would make it a lot easier to choose for a Best Picture. Because The Brothers Bloom is on fire. I've never seen all four of those actors. There's a girl from Babel, but there's Adrian Brody, Mark Ruffalo, and especially Rachel Weisz. They're on fire on that film.
That movie was not given a chance, and I'm not sure why.
But
doesn't it seem that it wasn't given a chance?
No, it wasn't given a chance at all. But he has a style. He has a style, I think, that Wes Anderson and Spike Jonze has. And I hope that I'm allowed that privilege to watch it evolve over this decade.
Yeah. Your next choice. Chris, anytime you want to chime in about these movies, go ahead.
Yeah, please interrupt me. You know, like, kick me in the nuts, please.
No, I'm listening. I'm like Jamie. I didn't have too much to add to Wong Kar Wai. Jody Hill, I'm sort of, I liked Foot Fist Way, but I can't say I liked Observe and Report. I do think he's somebody to watch, and I think the same thing, even more so, about Ryan Johnson. I loved Brick, and I liked Brothers Bloom. I think he's got a lot of range, and I think actually he's got a lot of versatility, so I agree,
Let me ask you this, Chris, before we go into my next choice. Do you think, though, he, in those two films, I know two films, it's hard to get a sense of style, but I do get that's what I got while watching The Brothers Bloom in the theater. Like a Wes Anderson, like a Spike Jonze, he does have a style. There's something, he's very smart, very literate, like Wes Anderson. Literate.
Anytime a director can make two movies that both have his distinctive scent on them, then in my opinion, he's someone to watch.
Okay.
And that's very true of him. Distinctive scent is rubbed all over those movies.
Okay. It's cool. The next choice, we're going to go with Noah Baumbach.
Ah.
And the reason I'm going to do this is because in the 90s we got Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, two wonderful films with Chris Eigman and just two wonderful films about 20-somethings.
And then he disappeared.
And he disappeared. And then he made two films that are so hard and so painful to watch, The Squid and the Whale, Margot at the Wedding, that leads me to think that he's making films for the true films of Generation X. The Squid and the Whale is the most honest film I've seen about what it's like to be the child of divorce. And I know you could say, oh, well, what about E.T.? No, E.T. is definitely an honest film about what it's like to be a child of divorce. But for our generation to make that film, or my generation to make that film, it's very important. Margot at the Wedding, holy shit. Nicole Kidman, she's the most vicious. She makes Summer Finn look like a Girl Scout. She's just evil in that film. But what I like about him is he's very honest. He doesn't hold back. He lets you know what he's he lets you know, hey, you know, these aren't likable characters, but I'm going to present them in a way. But what I like about A Squid and a Whale is, you know, I talk to some people, they think it's very funny, and then there are other people who have lived through that experience. It's a very depressing, very hard film to watch. My brother walked out of the room. He couldn't watch it. And when I watched Margot at the Wedding in the theater, several people walked out within the first half hour.
Yeah, I love that. I love this choice, Jerry. And I think Noah Baumbach actually has a lot in common with Woody Allen. And I think he his two movies from the 90s, as well as his two movies from this decade, are very similar to the kind of movies that Woody Allen's making. And especially the two from this decade, Margot at the Wedding and Squid and the Whale. Insanely good movies. Mm-hmm. Both illustrate perfectly and beautifully how nasty and painful and hurtful the people, more than anyone, the people that you love can be to you. No one can hurt you more. Both those movies, especially Squid and the Whale, illustrate that so well.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike anything I'd seen before, actually.
Yeah, no, I mean, Margaret at the Wedding, like, my mom was supposed to go see that with me, and when I got home, I told her, you would have walked out.
Yeah.
I said, you would have walked out within the first 20 minutes. Because, I mean, it's a very hard movie to watch.
And you're right about Nicole Kidman. Nicole Kidman, for a time there, threatened to be the female Nicolas Cage. She was just doing so much that it was a good reminder of her gifts, that
mm-hmm.
movie. Your next one.
Sofia Coppola.
Exactly. Yeah, of course.
You knew that was coming. You all knew that was coming because if you were watching what I was watching yesterday, I watched Marie Antoinette last night. But it's The Virgin Suicides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's what she has with Kirsten Dunst, using her as her surrogate almost in that movie in Marie Antoinette. Not to say I love Lost in Translation, but I think the thing about Sofia Coppola that's very interesting is The Virgin Suicides comes under the radar. A lot of people have written her off from The Godfather 3, which I had no problem with her performance, but what do I know? And The Virgin Suicides is the most accurate depiction I've seen of the 70s at that point. I'm just saying at that point, and the gentleman who does the cinematography, and I don't have the name at the top of my head right now, it's a beautiful film. It reminds me of what it was like to grow up during that time, but she really hit on something there. And that book, I went home after I went to a special screening of that film. I went home, bought the book, read it the next day, and I was just blown away by everything that movie and book had to offer. And then there's Lost in Translation. And then several years later, there's Marie Antoinette. She's a very personal filmmaker, and she identifies very strongly with each subject. And she identifies with Marie Antoinette in the sense that she grew up in the court of Francis Ford Coppola. And that's really what that film is about, growing up in...
I think Marie Antoinette is actually her most underrated movie, like more,
it's
even
a
more
great
so,
film.
Even more so than The Virgin Suicides. Like, really, really good movie, and really sort of written off as not as good as Lost in Translation. I disagree. Could not disagree more.
There's a very personal independence of spirit that Sofia Coppola has right at the outset of her career, and you can't help but make the parallels between her and her father. Yeah, she inherited a lot. Your next choice. which would be number five.
Number five, thank you. I'm glad someone knows how to count. You guys are great. You know how to count. I don't, unfortunately. That might explain my failure in high school math. But my next choice is Greg, and you'll forgive me if I mispronounce his last name, Greg Motola, who made Adventureland.
Motola, yeah.
Motola, I'm sorry. Motola. And he also made Superbad. And in the previous decade, he made The Day Trippers. I like Superbad. I think it's very funny. I think you could take it out of the equation, and he's made two really awesome films, The Day Trippers and Adventureland. Adventureland is one of the finest coming-of-age movies I've seen in a long time. It hits very close to home. It's perfect. It captures the 80s very well. But it's The Day Trippers. I know it wasn't in this decade, but I keep referencing The Day Trippers every week. Maybe it's the Liv Scribner character because he makes a jackass out of himself, and I think of him a lot. But that's a great film. But Adventureland, I don't think I've ever seen a better coming-of-age film.
It's amazing the kind of reaction that some people had to Adventureland. And I won't say that I didn't like the movie, but there's a certain group of people, and you're among them, who had the kind of reaction to this movie that leads me to believe that it will only become more of a cult classic as time goes on, and I will learn to appreciate it more. I liked the movie, but more than liking the movie, I think it's important to recognize that there's a group of people, again, you included, who had this very visceral reaction to that movie, and that accounts for something.
We went to go see it the Friday it came out. The sound died at the most crucial point of the film. I went back the next day to see it again. I was not bored at all to the point where I wanted to see, and I'd missed, there are a lot of people who didn't know, wow, that's the most important part of the movie. I mean, we're in this 5 minutes where the sound died. I went back, but even up to that point, I was like, my God, I like this film even more the second time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really powerful film.
You know what impresses me about it, too, and I've said this about another movie recently, and I can't remember which one, but in dealing with the 80s decade, it's not obvious. I mean, there are obvious ways that you can portray a decade, or the movie can just exist in that decade.
It's
you don't
very
have to draw
authentic.
Draw attention to it. Yeah, that was impressive to me.
Yeah.
Your next choice, Jerry.
Number four?
Sure.
Is it number
four? Number four.
Or you're fooling with me. I feel like the blind man who goes to the library. No, Todd Field. Todd Field is a very important choice. I like his first film, this actor. He directed In the Bedroom, but nothing can compare to Little Children. I was not looking forward to Little Children before I saw it, because I thought the trailer was mediocre at best.
It felt like something we'd seen before.
Yeah.
The trailer did.
Yeah, the trailer is a really bad trailer.
With the train
sounds in the background and everything. It's just like, what is this?
It's like we saw American Beauty.
Yeah. As soon as the lights go down, as soon as the credits start, and we're introduced to that playground sequence, I refused to get out of my seat. I was just totally wrapped up in what Kate Winslet, Patrick Wilson, Jennifer Connelly, Jacker Hurley, everyone was just so engrossing. But I will say this right now. Never before has an actress deserved an Academy Award than for Kate Winslet for the book club sequence. When she makes that thing about Madame Bovary, and it's not just that scene, but it's also the dinner scene when they're all together with Jennifer Connelly and everything, where you see how far she's lost it. It's just incredible. I don't remember being that wrapped up in the film before that. For a long time, that I wasn't looking forward to. I really wasn't looking forward to the film. It was just one of the things you want to get out of the way. And I just got so sucked into it.
Yeah.
It's a great movie, and the uniqueness of the narration, too, the voiceover narration, impressed me. And the journey of the characters in the movie, brave enough to say, can you dare to sympathize with a child molester? And I thought that one of the most sympathetic characters in that movie is Jackie Earl Haley's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like breaking down every time she was so desperately trying to defend her son.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most emotional part of that movie for me.
You're right.
In my opinion, Little Children suffers from what I would call Casino syndrome, which is to say, just like Casino came out after Goodfellas, but if Casino had come out first, I think we would remember Casino as the better movie, and some of us do. But I think that Little Children has that problem with American Beauty.
Oh,
to say
you're
that.
Right.
If Little Children had come out first and American Beauty had come out 5 years later, American Beauty would have been nominated for a bunch of shit, but not one, whereas 5 years previous, Little Children probably would have won Best Picture. Mm. They deal with very similar,
right,
very similar themes, in fact, almost identical themes, but the execution, once again, with Little Children is far greater than American Beauty. Much more memorable movie, much more haunting and a rich movie. Yeah.
Well, just a little footnote. I spoke to Todd Field briefly.
Yeah. I've been waiting for him to be back on with his new movie.
It's an interesting story, but he's got an untitled movie that's being kept under wraps, but I think he's working on it now. And he promised us he'd come see us when the movie comes out. So we may have a chance to drill him about Little Children, so to speak. Your next choice, Jerry.
Number three, John Hillcoat, The Proposition and The Road. The Proposition, I've talked too much about it on this show and on the other show, but it's magnificent. Enough can't be said about it, but I've never talked about The Road on this show because it's a very hard film to talk about, and never before has a director and an author have been meant to be together as John Hillcoat and Cormac McCarthy. They're perfect. And I know a lot of people are saying, oh, well, Jerry, you wanted to like The Road. And a lot of people don't like The Road because it's bleak. Well, it's a movie about the end of the world. What did you expect? Mary fucking Poppins? I mean, it's the end of the world. It's doomsday. I mean, it's every sense. It's the worst possible scenario you can expect, but John Hillcoat is perfectly suited for this given his Western The Proposition, which in many ways is Heart of Darkness set in the outback in the colonial area in Australia. But I just think John Hillcoat, the world is, he can do whatever he wants, and I wish he would have done all the Pretty Horses. I wish he'd do all of Cormac McCarthy's books. He
Blood Meridian, please.
Well, I think Todd Field is attached to Blood Meridian.
Is that right? Oh.
I think. I'm not positive about that. Don't quote me. Oh, God, I can see people are going to quote me on this. But don't quote me on that.
Hillcoat would do wonders with it.
So. Yeah, I mean, but I'm watching The Road, and it's a very good movie. And it's a movie that should be, you know, people are making, and I like The Book of Eli a lot, and I would hope that people would talk about both of them, compare them up, because they're both worthy of comparison and how they treat, in the different ways they treat the subject matter of the end of the world. But Hillcoat just has this unique vision of the West, and the post-apocalyptic is the West as well, as Manola Dargis just pointed out in her review of The Book of Eli. But he just has this unique vision, and it's so intoxicating to watch. Even if he just made The Proposition, if that was the only film he made, I would say this film is incredible. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. It's just a wonderful film.
And really a movie where Danny Houston comes alive, which I did,
He earns his last name.
In that movie, he does. And I've never been one to be taken by him, but I sure was in that movie, The Proposition.
Yeah.
Your next choice, which would be your number two.
My number two is going to make all of you just groan. Richard Kelly. Come on, Chris. You know you hate me for that. You hate me for that choice.
No, I wasn't. That noise was not for Richard Kelly himself. That noise was in reaction to you saying that I would groan. Because I think he fits very well into this list of yours. Because really, this list has been about essentially the rookies. Like, this is the guys.
Thank you. I love you for this.
Not necessarily the cream of the crop. These are the guys that we need to keep an eye on, because these are the guys that are going to be the next, there's sort of three classes right now working. You've got the guys like Eastwood and Spielberg and Scorsese. Then you've got, you know, the the juniors, you've got the Wes Andersons and the Paul Thomas Andersons and the Quentin Tarantinos. And
you know,
then
all guys
these
I
the,
love, you know, that I work
with. No, and I do too. But this list of yours, from what I can tell so far, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, is the freshman.
Yeah.
And I like it. And I think that he deserves to be on that list.
Okay, can I tell why he's on this list? Because I wrote a review of the box that will be on my tombstone, that I'll be the guy that, like, defended Richard Kelly till the end. But I want to say what brought me to this defense of Richard Kelly. And while I love Southland Tales, and I do like the box a lot, and I adore Donnie Darko, when the box came out in the first weekend of November of 2009, I Twitter that be-all, end-all of film criticism, I guess now, people were condemning the box to, and Richard Kelly for that matter, to death. And when I finally saw someone write The Fourth Kind is a better movie, which I had seen, I was like, I gotta come to this man's defense. There's no way that you could think The Fourth Kind is a better movie. I don't care who you are. You need to defend the box. We always complain with in the summer blockbusters that there's a deficit of creativity. And you know, when you look at something like G.I. Joe or Transformers, that's an easy case to make. There's just, it's really, they're bland films. They're big, they're explosions, but do you remember anything about those films?
No.
No, I mean, and Chris, you're right to condemn me for liking the first Transformers. It's fun, but it's a bad film. It's a piece of shit. It's crap. And then you're absolutely right in your, what you said about that film, our first summer on the air. When I look at someone like Richard Kelly, I see someone who's so creative, has so many ideas, he just doesn't have someone to help him funnel those ideas into a cohesive screenplay. It's not to say he makes bad films. He makes very interesting films. He makes films that I'll remember, but he does need someone to help him out. But he is such a creative vision. He is obsessed with – all right, if John Hillcoat and the Hughes brothers are obsessed with what happens after the end of the world, he's obsessed with what happens before. There's a lot of anxiety he's about what happens before the world ends.
I'll say one thing for him, and I like him. I like Donnie Darko. I even like Southland Tales more than most people. But he's not lazy. No one is going to be accusing this guy of being a lazy filmmaker. Does not take the easy choices.
No, he
does not take the easy way out. He's interested in making singular movies that have his vision. I like that. I feel like this again. He's one of the freshmen. He's one of the guys to keep an eye on.
I think that in this list, part of what Chris has been saying too about it.
It's true.
It's not just for the past decade. It's looking ahead and looking forward to where these filmmakers go in the next decade. I hope that Richard Kelly gets a chance to continue on his path because he hasn't been getting a lot of studio support.
No, he hasn't gotten studio support. He got it's not just Twitter, but it's also that Entertainment Weekly issue that came out after the box was released. There were three articles. It was the box office list. It was a little article about the box, and it was a review of the box. It just said his career was over.
Mm-hmm.
And it really pissed me off.
No, that's just someone who doesn't like him writing that article, I guarantee you.
Well, he himself said it. He himself said, I'm afraid that my career will be over if the box
fails. He did say
that,
and then he went to go see A Christmas Carol for the sixth time that weekend.
Okay, so your last choice, which is number one.
You know the last choice. This is not a surprise to anyone. David Gordon Green.
Yes.
Okay, that was a gift.
Fits so perfectly on this list, too.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm so glad that this actually has a motif on this list. As I was thinking about that yesterday, does this have a motif? And it does. And, Chris, I really appreciate you. You don't know how much I appreciate you for bringing that out. But David Gordon Green, who I've gone back, we watched Undertow last week, All the Real Girls. I haven't gone back to watch George Washington recently, and I haven't gone back to watch Snow Angels because I don't have a clean razor blade with me to watch it with because it's a depressing film. But I think the next decade belongs to him. I'm not just saying – I don't know about Your Highness. I have a big question mark about Your Highness because it Pineapple Express, while I think it's a very funny movie and everything, the criticism against it is the tonal shift in the third act. It goes from this stoner comedy to this,
like action, like 48 Hours and Midnight Run. Your Highness has, I think, a big benefit to it. It's a spoof of all these movies, and if that's what the tone is, I don't know what the tone is yet, but you have Robin Hood with Russell Crowe coming out. You have Clash of the Titans coming out with in the March, and it could be the perfect thing to spoof these films, if that's what it is. I don't know. And it's not the film that he's following this up with is not any easier. It's Suspiria, Dario Argento's film, a classic film, and it's a remake. And he's never done a horror film before. But I think that because he's proven himself in these unknown territories that he can do it, I think he might be able to do that. And I just think he's someone to watch out for because he hasn't let me down yet in five films.
No. He is, if I were an odds maker, if I were Ace Rothstein, and I were betting on who, a director who has never been nominated for an Oscar, who will one day win an Oscar, he would be my number one choice. He's the one guy who it seems like it's absolutely a fait accompli. This guy will one day make a film that will capture the entire country's imagination, if not the world. Like, he just feels like that kind of filmmaker.
Right.
He's going to make something someday that's really important. And that's not to say that his other movies have not been important. In fact, I think All the Real Girls in particular is the one that people will remember as kind of his McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Like, no one really knows about it now. No one paid attention. But in years to come, that movie will be looked at and remembered. Like, it's a really well-made movie. And Snow Angels also in particular.
I think Snow Angels is great. It's just so depressing. But if you
I don't know how that movie disappeared. I don't know how that movie got buried in the snow, as it were. Really, really strong movie from last year.
And it's a great performance from Rockwell. Just
oh my God.
Powerful,
yeah.
Powerhouse
yeah.
performance from him. And Kate Beckinsale, too.
Yeah.
Great list. Jerry's top 10 directors of distinction for the decade. Wong Kar-wai, Jodie Hill, Ryan Johnson, Noah Baumbach, Sofia Coppola, Greg Mottola, Todd Field, John Hillcoat, Richard Kelly, and David Gordon Green. You're going to hear a lot about these people in the next decade, so you better study up and watch their previous films.
You can come over to my house and watch the films.
Exactly. It's an open invitation from Jerry. So.
Yeah, I know, really.
Put your address in the chat room, Jerry. Go ahead. all right, we're still right on time. This is a well-oiled machine, this show tonight. It's great.
Yeah, we're going to get to watch the Globes on time.
That's right, and who wants to miss that opening number from Nell Carter?
Yeah.
Should I play it again? No.
Please, no.
Okay, I'm here to review the top 10 movie trends of the decade, the ones that took me the most. And like all trends, they have their roots in years and decades previous, but they really came to prominence in the 2000s decade. And these are trends that I have to read out from a script in a way.
Now, let me ask you, are they ranked? Is there some sort of
I rank them just so there's a 10. Yeah, there's a ranking.
Okay.
There's a ranking in the idea that their prominence, their importance, and where they'll be taken into the next decade in a way.
All right.
Number 10, TV teaches movies a thing or two. The parts are still there. They're just on smaller screens. Martin Sheen, Charlie Sheen, Kiefer Sutherland, Glenn Close, William Hurt, Gary Sinise, Holly Hunter, James Spader, Kira Sedgwick, these are just a few of the actors who have had their own successful TV series. And the TV movie used to be the kiss of death, but now that's all changed, especially if you're HBO, where they get talents like Pacino and Streep and Spacey and Thompson and directors like Scorsese and Michael Mann, and how even Tarantino got into the CSI business. So that career-deadening stench that was once associated with TV is no longer relevant. And as a result, I ask you guys, have our movie stars gotten smaller? Or is it just a question of the level of good writing in TV as opposed to the weakened writing in film?
A really interesting question. And
that is.
I'm surprised that this, as a theme, is not higher. I know that Bill Simmons, the sports guy on ESPN, and Chuck Klosterman were having a conversation a couple months ago thinking about the decade in film, and that was sort of the conclusion that they came to finally, was that film, really, this decade was sort of overshadowed by television, by shows like The Sopranos, by shows like Lost and 24 and things like this. It's really kind of amazing the steps that TV has taken. And what it says about film, I don't know, because we've talked about this before. I still feel like there's just as many good movies made every year, but I feel like there's more good television shows. And certainly film could learn a lot from some of the serials.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, the police procedurals and, you know, the sitcoms, nothing's changed there, but the serial shows have really, really taken it to another level.
Totally.
Well, this probably should be higher. If you think about relevance, these are just things I've been taken by. But it goes beyond this. There's a different level of intimacy when you watch an actor on the big screen as opposed to the small screen.
Yeah.
And that's just it. You feel intimate with them when you watch them at home. But there's also another thing related to TV. And it's been there years previous to the 2000s decade, but really came alive this past decade, which is a lot of people are going to the movies to watch TV more and more.
How do you mean?
Well, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Dukes of Hazzard, Sex and the City, Bewitched, The A-Team coming out this summer. I mean, and you understand why, because they're built-in brands. There's a familiarity and a comfort there that people will go see some of these things.
Yeah.
They sell themselves in a way.
Yeah.
And I've seen more and more of that this past decade.
Yeah, not necessarily always a good thing. In fact, often it's a very, very bad thing. But you got to wonder, in years to come, will we be seeing a Sopranos movie? Will we be seeing a Lost movie? Will we see a 24?
And they want to make all of that, except Sopranos.
Well, they're doing it quicker and quicker. We're seeing Sex and the City movies. We're seeing Simpsons movies, Family Guy movies. It's happening quicker and quicker.
Jackass.
Oh, you're right.
I mean, Jackass, reality TV put on the big screen. So are we going to see I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, the movie?
The Jersey Shore movie? How about that?
I feel so out of it because I've never watched Jersey Shore. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question, Jamie, and I think it's really, really I'm really excited to hear the rest of the list now because I find it difficult to believe that there's an issue that is
stronger
than that.
Well, forget that because it won't be. so forget that expectation.
Well, then it's a great opening conversation then about
it. Yeah, it is.
My number 9 is the musical is reborn, but is the genre already singing its swan song? Sure, Disney succeeded in the 90s with a string of music-filled animated features, but what about the return to good old big Hollywood musical spectaculars? Crybaby and Newsies might have gained some level of cult status, but it failed to ignite the mainstream. Evita came closest in 96, but failed to recoup its $55 million budget. But this was the decade that opened with Moulin Rouge, a very unexpected and curious mainstream phenomenon, if there ever was one. And then came Chicago, a Best Picture winner, and a formidable financial success. The genre looked to be on the rise. Then, mid-decade, we saw Rent, Phantom of the Opera, and The Producers. And was the decade ending 9 the final nail in the coffin? Apparently not, because a movie called Burlesque is on its way, featuring that dynamic thong-wearing duo of Christina Aguilera and Cher. And like most trends, Hollywood has found a way to capitalize on the surprise return of the big-screen musical and exploit it right back into a coma. Do you think musicals are dead again, is my question.
Mm. Or a better question, should they make Dead Again the musical? No. I won't say no. I'll say yes for right now. Because someone could have asked that question in the early 70s, and everyone would have said, well, yes, musicals are dead. But it's one of those things where eventually we'll get another Moulin Rouge. But it is an interesting question because yes, I do think for right now they're dead, and I don't think this Burlesque movie has a chance. Once again, 9, and I haven't seen 9, but would 9 be different had it come out before Chicago, or is Chicago just a better movie? I don't know. I didn't like Chicago. Musicals are not my thing, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think this is the kind of thing that ever goes away, and I'll tell you why. Women love musicals. I mean, I don't know what it is, but they love musicals. I mean, and by the way, wait till Hugh Jackman makes a musical. And there's plenty of other Broadway shows that are always coming out that that will turn into someone will turn him into a movie, and it might not happen this year, might not happen next year, it might be another 10 years. But I just musical is just a genre that I have a hard time counting out.
It did have a surprise return this past decade, and it was a surprise because they've been dead a long time. But what's most interesting to me, and there's a couple that fall into this category on this list, is the last thing I said. They have a formula. They're like, oh, musicals are making money again. Let's flood them with a bunch of musicals, most of which will suck. And that killed them again, I think. Hollywood is its own worst enemy in a way.
That's
for a lot
true.
Of these trends. Yeah. This is another trend. Number 8, mainstream audiences get a craving for porn, or at least the torturous kind. Remember the days when the rampages of horror villains like Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers seemed quaint? Now, thanks to a little behemoth known as the Saw series, those days are gone, with few exceptions. This was the decade that produced horror films that were only concerned with one goal, one-upmanship. My movie's more disgusting than your movie. Horror has always played in the controversy sandbox, but in the 2000s, that same spirit produced huge sums of money the horror directors of old can only dream about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this wasn't the only horror trend this past decade. If we didn't take our scares from pornographic scenes of torture, Hollywood seemed to think we'd want them with an Asian slant, no pun intended.
Oh, God, damn, Jamie, I didn't think of that.
Where is the horror genre? Where's it going?
Well, once again, I'm glad you did this list, because it may raise some really interesting questions here. I do think that the torture porn thing is dead. Like,
it's gone.
You can't pronounce the musical dead, but I do feel like we can pronounce the that's not to say there won't be any more torture porns made, and it's also not to say that there won't be another good or successful one. I just don't think that it will become a trend again. Because it came and went so quickly. We were sick of it by the time the second and third Saw movie came around and the second Hostel movie. And by the way, there's really no further to go. Like, there's really, like, how much grosser can you get?
We've seen a
circulating Saw grind to a halt in a girl's skull. Like, we've seen
You know what's going to happen? What is very interesting. That's just it. How much farther can you go until people get sick of it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we've reached that point, and I think that we've seen the other side of it too. You revert. You revert back to showing nothing, alluding to everything, and that's why Paranormal Activity is such a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think the trend has run its course, but I think it is a strange trend.
Yeah.
Especially on the heels of 9/11, where we just had to have it, and the fact that morality is tied up with this, the fact that Jigsaw in many circles is seen as a character that represents the morality of the piece, even though he's the perpetrator of all this torture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is another
horror point. Horror movies as a genre are interesting because as the decades have gone on. They have had the sort of subgenres that overtake the genre itself, like, and really sort of last the whole decade. In the 80s movies, it was the slasher movie where the villain was this sort of supernatural force, whether it was Michael Myers or Jason or Freddy Krueger, and that sort of lasted that whole decade. In the 90s, really kind of kicked off in the mid-90s with Scream, you had, like, the teenage thing going on where, you know, I mean, there was a killer out to get a bunch of kids, and we really probably saw 25, 30 movies that were essentially exactly like that, and they were all very popular, from Final Destination to Urban Legends and Scream movies and all this kind of shit. And then this decade, it was the torture porn movies. I mean, there were exceptions in every decade, but in the last three decades, we've seen these sort of subgenres overtake the genre itself. So who knows where the next trend in horror movies is going to be, but the thing is, in every year, there is horror movies is something that there's a huge audience for.
Is
and they
3D?
Don't always, and they're not the easiest audience to fool, really.
No, they're not.
They're uniquely
qualified to appeal to something primal in the culture itself and comment upon it without hitting you over the head with it with a hammer, which a lot of these movies have those scenes. Yeah. Oh, you saw House of the Devil.
Oh, loved it.
That's the movie. That's the movie with the 80s that feels like it was made in the 80s that I was talking about.
Yeah, it really does. It's a really interesting movie. I don't know. I can't remember the name of the director off the top of my head.
Ty West,
Ty West, yeah. He is somebody to watch because that was a fun movie. That was a really, really fun 80s movie or 80s type horror movie. And maybe it's because I was raised in the 80s and I love the 80s and all that kind of shit. But I just thought it was a really fun horror movie to watch, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. And I watched it by myself, and I just enjoyed the hell out of it. So,
I did too. I'm glad you watched it, dude. Number seven, raunch sells, especially when it comes from the heart. For some frame of reference to this phenomenon of the past decade, look a little further into the past. Take Porky's and mix it with a little John Hughes, and you've got the sensibilities of Judd Apatow, who wrote and directed The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, which mined this formula beautifully. These were two of the raunchiest films in the year they were released, but also two of the most touching. And then we have Funny People, which made the mistake of straying from Apatow's winning formula, and ironically, wasn't funny. Maybe we saw this trend coming in 1998 when Cameron Diaz moosed her hair with The Seed of Man, but in terms of raunch, nothing compares to this decade, the decade that brought us Van Wilder's delicious pastries filled with dog semen, Jason Biggs supergluing his hand to his penis, and Will Ferrell playing the drums with his balls. And now we have The Hangover, which soon might breathe the rarefied air of Oscar nominee. What do you guys think of this whole subgenre of comedy now?
Wow. I will say this. I think Bradley Cooper's finest hour may be The Hangover. Just looking at all the, I didn't realize all these other films that he was in that I had seen. I didn't notice him in, but that he is the unsung hero of The Hangover. I know a lot of people want to say Zach Galifianakis, but he's really, I think, the breakthrough performance in that film. But I think you're right. this whole decade has been reaching up to Cat. You had to bring up the Step Brothers, didn't you?
It mirrors horror. Like, how far can we go?
Does, you had to bring up the balls on the drum set.
Yeah, but how far can we go? How shocking can we go until we've reached that plateau? Yeah.
Well, I do think there's a difference, though. When you've seen a circulating saw grind to a halt in a girl's skull, you don't ever want to see it again. A guy whipping out his balls on a snare drum is always funny. It's always funny. It's always going to be funny. And especially, strangely, The Hangover is a great family movie. And I say that maybe because my family has a sick, twisted sense of humor. I don't mean the kind of movie you take your kids to. I mean the kind the kind of movie that adults go with their adult parents to go
mm-hmm.
see. It's the kind of movie that really is such a fun time to go see with other adults. It's obviously not for children. Neither was There Something About Mary. Neither was Animal House or any of these gross-out kind of movies.
Oh,
I don't think this will go away.
They have values, though, which is what's so fascinating about them. They shock, they disgust in the service of laughter, and there's genuine laughter in these movies. But they all have heart. They all have values. They value friendship. They value
mm-hmm.
family and love and all. You feel that in these movies.
Yeah, and the ones that don't have that don't work.
No, they don't work at all.
Like Van Wilder, for instance. I know some people love that movie, but I don't think it has that kind of moral grounding that that, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin has, that Hangover has, that There's Something About Mary has. I don't think it has that, and therefore it doesn't have the kind of weight. It didn't become the kind of phenomenon that those other three movies did.
Yeah. All right, our number six. Professional critics are a dying breed. As more and more newspapers go under, and even the giants in the publishing business suffer from the financial pinch and a changing internet-driven landscape, so have gone the careers of countless film critics, as they are usually among the initial victims of the chopping block. These critics include Premiere's Glenn Kinney, USA Today's Mike Clark, Newsweek's David Anson, The New York Daily News' Jack Matthews, and the Chicago Tribune's Michael Wilmington, just to name a few. Now, several of these high-profile critics have turned to writing criticism in the blogosphere, where they are joined by every Joe Schmo with a keyboard and an opinion, most of which are underdeveloped and sophomoric, but some of them are actually exemplary voices of criticism and utilize the forum brilliantly. Many newspapers and magazines have declared the value of the professional film critic with their pink slips, but what is their value to the culture and our society at large, and are we a poorer society without them?
Yes. We always need Roger Ebert.
We always need someone out there who is writing, and it's just like any form of literature, really. We're all, we're going to be at a great loss when Stephen King dies. We're going to be at a great loss when Roger Ebert dies. Now, I know we're not talking about people dying here, but,
no, but
in Roger Ebert's case, we're actually talking about both.
I agree with Chris there. I mean that partially as a joke, and I mean that partially
in all sincerity. Because when Glenn Kinney no longer has that job, he is in the blogosphere among all those schmoes, and he doesn't have that megaphone that he used to have. And he's a good writer, and maybe he should still have that megaphone. And,
well, look, Roger Ebert will not be unemployed, and there will always be an AP. It is cheaper for them to syndicate their writings than it is to hire film critics of their own. And that's what we're going to see.
You're going to see fewer and fewer voices. And if you have fewer and fewer voices, then you're not going to get a chance to have that one defining voice. And for the last 20 years, that defining voice, ever since Cale died, or stopped writing, I should say, Roger Ebert is that voice. And I don't know that anyone really can argue with that.
His writing
is really important to film.
And that's important. You said the writing, not the TV show so much, but it's like, it's him, it's Manola Dargis, it's Kim Morgan, it's Glenn Kenny, David Thompson. There are a couple of critics that are definitely, you know, keeping, you know, letting us know, hey, maybe we're not looking at everything. There's a foreign film. There's an independent film that deserves a look.
And also exposure to critical thought, I think, is important.
Oh, very important.
And guys and girls, writers, who don't have an agenda. And unfortunately, in the blogosphere, there are just way too many people that have an agenda, and it's perfectly obvious when you read their criticism. When you read Roger Ebert, you do not ever get the impression. I've never once read his work and got the impression that he has an agenda. And
he wants to love the
writers out there like that.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to look at his review for The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. He really liked The Phantom Menace. He hated Attack of the Clones. And while that's not a great example to use, I just think, you know, just to show he doesn't play favorites, he was willing to really attack Lucas to say, you really dropped, I mean, I would have said he dropped the ball with Phantom Menace, but at least Ebert was like, okay, you dropped the ball with this one. And I think that's a good example to use in Ebert's case.
We got 15 minutes to run through the rest of these. Number five, is the independent spirit of the 90s dead or just mutating? The cinema of the 90s, if nothing else, solidified the era of the independent film movement. The groundwork laid by Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, the flowering of Miramax, and the increasing relevance of Sundance raised hopes for the prominence of a different kind of movie. Perhaps the movement's biggest blessing and its biggest curse was Pulp Fiction, a thunderbolt to the industry that wound up grossing over $100 million. This got the studio thinking there was a lot of money that could be mined from these outside-of-the-box films. In the past decade, most of these big studios started their own specialty film divisions or bought the established ones outright. I mean, were there ever stranger cinematic bedfellows than Miramax and Disney? Today, that landscape has changed as Disney has scaled back Miramax considerably. Paramount has closed Paramount Vantage. Time Warner shut down Warner Independent, as well as Picture House, and absorbed New Line into Warner Brothers. And Universal sold Rogue, their specialty division. Now, there could be a couple of reasons why. Maybe there are too many films, most indie films are just as bad as the big studio films, or maybe it's the reasoning that the studios give, that there's no longer room for medium-sized pictures, not when you can make a $200 million movie and gross $1 billion from it, or when you can buy the $15,000 Paranormal Activity and gross over $100 million on it. They're not in the business of making $20 to $40 million movies anymore.
Right. That's why the Brothers Bloom got buried.
Yeah.
You asked that question earlier, that's the answer. It's a medium-sized movie. And there's just no place for movies like that anymore.
Number four. Sorry. go ahead. Did you have something?
All I was going to say is that this is the first question you've raised that really there's no answer to.
Yeah, there's no answer. Not one that I could give to get us off the air in time. So
no, but it is happening. I mean,
yeah, it is. You're right.
Number four, never forget 9/11, although in respect to the movies, sometimes we should. It's become the defining event of this generation, but how has it manifested itself into the movies? After an initial period of great trepidation, we were given the most brilliant of all films to deal with the tragedy of 9/11, the Paul Greengrass masterpiece United 93, which was followed by the disappointing World Trade Center, the Oliver Stone film with a Ron Howard personality. And then Fahrenheit 9/11, of course. And we have the films that deal with the after effects of that event, mainly the New Age of War films, which vary in quality and resonance. But what interests me most are the films on the fringes, the ones that don't deal directly with 9/11, but the experiences of that devastating day are embedded in their bones. Spike Lee's 25th Hour is the shining example of this,
mm-hmm.
one of the great films of the decade.
Yeah.
And really the first film out of the gate to express the post-9/11 mentality. Spielberg's War of the Worlds was a mixed bag, but there were haunting images that immediately recalled the chaotic horrors of that day. But oftentimes, I think it's not the films that reflect 9/11 so much as the audiences themselves, because we see buildings crumble and explosions rumble, and we can't help but draw the parallels in our own minds. Our perception is even colored when we watch Drek like 2012.
There's one film that does it really well, and it has nothing to do, and it takes place chronologically long before 9/11, and that's Fincher's Zodiac.
Yeah.
That's another film.
That's another thing. There are a series of films where we read 9/11 into them,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that in all cases if it's intentional on the filmmaker's part.
It might not be for that one, it's his film, and he can certainly disagree. But I do think there's a level of fear, like the fear, to leave your house, your apartment, or whatever in the city because it's killers at large. That does manifest itself into what it was like after the immediate months after 9/11. People were scared to do anything.
Audiences,
but I don't know if he had that in mind. I don't know.
Audiences, their perception has changed. In a very insidious way, in a way that I don't think they're aware of. And I don't know if that translates into what they choose to go see. Do they choose to go see the dumbest possible movie? Do they make Paul Blart a $120 million movie because they want to put their brain on stupid because of the world that they're living in?
That's a good point.
I think it's true. You know what the first number one movie after 9/11 was?
Zoolander. Yeah.
Zoolander. Ooh. Nothing could personify that topic that you're talking about more than Zoolander. And I love Zoolander. I think it's a comedic gold. In fact, that is one of those movies that was on my top 20. That movie is one of the best movies of the decade, in my opinion. But it resonated that week. More than it would have. Strangely, 9/11 helped Zoolander.
Yeah.
People wanted to just go have a good time, and I do think that sentiment has lingered. I think that's definitely lingered. We've seen a dumbing down. Paul Blart would have been a direct-to-VHS movie in 1999.
Yeah, let me bring up...
We would not have seen it.
Yeah,
go ahead,
our a good friend of our show, who was one of our first guests on Jeremy Samos, Samus was on, he mentioned Cloverfield. Cloverfield may be probably one of the best post 9/11 movies to really deal with the hysteria and the fear and everything. And that's a really good film to bring up. Cloverfield.
It is, but it doesn't have to talk about it directly. And I'm also curious, when will a movie be brave enough to talk about it directly in the big picture, just not a minutia feel good story like what you have with World Trade Center? When will there ever be an immersive, all-inclusive 9/11 movie?
Yeah, there will be. But
there will
it's hard
be.
To imagine who will make it and when it will happen.
Yeah,
but it's
so politicized right now, though.
It is. But look how long it took to get that Vietnam movie. You know, I mean, it took
you're right. You're right, Chris.
It took 15 years till we got Platoon, which is really... I mean, I know we had Coming Home and we had Apocalypse Now, but again, those movies sort of dealt with it indirectly. Platoon was the first movie that said, here it is, deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably going to be 15 years. It's probably, in the next 5 years, we'll probably see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, We've come a long way from Jar Jar. One day, flesh and blood actors will become obsolete, only to be replaced by the imaginings of a tech geek sitting in front of a workstation. At least that was the fear when George Lucas lashed Jar Jar Binks onto the world with a Phantom Menace. But now, given the efforts of trailblazers like Peter Jackson and James Cameron, Misa no think so. We'll be seeing a lot more computer-generated characters in the future. And the good news is that they will require the physicality, and as seen in the bar-raising movie Avatar, the emotionality of actors to work. If anything, I think this could mean more opportunities and braver performances from actors. But organizations like the Academy will have to face a decision. Should these performances be recognized alongside real-world performances?
Only if they deserve to be. You know, only if they deserve to be. I, that's the best way I can say it. And frankly, I think they deserve to be a long time ago. I think Andy Serkis deserved to be recognized for the Lord of the Rings movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think
agree.
What he did in that movie was you know, more important than what Avatar did, really. And I think, and James Cameron himself has said it. When they saw Gollum, they said, okay, it's time. We can do it now. And frankly, I don't think that there has been a performance like that that is CGI motion capture since Gollum. Like, maybe Zoe Saldana in Avatar, she's quite good, and Sam Worthington is also, but I don't think there's been anything like Gollum. So when they deserve to be recognized, yes, they should be. But
it's
strange,
a hurdle.
Because it's what now?
It's a hurdle. I mean, the perception of these people, they really have to let them know, this is all acting. This is all the actor's doing, because it is a hurdle, the perception of it.
Absolutely. And
you're
it's
right.
Weird because I'm thinking about somebody like no name comes to mind when you have this conversation. For me, the first name that jumps to my mind when you have this conversation is Robert Zemeckis. And
yeah.
I just want to scream to the heavens, Robert Zemeckis, what the fuck are you doing? Like,
well, I know Robert Zemeckis has to be pissed about Cameron. I mean, his jaw has to be on the floor, and he's like, he beat me. But Robert Zemeckis did some initial, I mean, he started it. I mean, he really believed in it. He just didn't achieve it fully like Cameron did.
He didn't achieve it even partially. Polar Express does not work. Beowulf does not work. Christmas Carol did not work. It does not work on that level. And it's really weird, too, because that's not a reflection of Robert Zemeckis. I consider Robert Zemeckis to be on the James Cameron, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese level. I love his movies. I love his live-action movies. When he started doing this, he is just, as a filmmaker, strangely, I just don't think he's not shown that he's capable of doing it. Maybe it's the kind of technique or something about it does not work for him.
Number two, digital, I'm sorry, I was just going for it. Number two, digital is no longer just an indie's best friend. The line between film and digital video has officially been blurred beyond the point of recognition. The new technology is no longer just the darling of the independent film movement. You see it in some of the better films of the past decade, movies like Zodiac, Rachel Getting Married, Collateral, Avatar, and I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry.
Public Enemies.
Hold for laughs. The technology allows filmmakers more flexibility and, in many cases, a greater sense of creative freedom, and it's much less laborious to edit. In this upcoming decade, film may be obsolete, and how's that for a trend in film, the end of film itself? That's my number
no
two.
Better example than Zodiac. No
yeah.
better example. Like,
yeah.
really, like, when you mention all those other movies, and then you mention Zodiac, it's kind of like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
That was shot? Wait, really? It's
yeah.
kind of hard to believe if you watch
it. I know,
the
it
movie.
Is. It really is.
Does it mean the death of film? Maybe. If that's the touchstone, if that's the bar, then maybe it does mean the death of film.
I think it's 70% or 80% there.
Yeah.
And then you have the people clutching with their claws, like Tarantino, that says, if I can't shoot on film, I'm not going to shoot another movie ever.
Oh, I doubt that. He'll find a way.
Well, he said that, but
well, I know
yeah.
he said that. But he also said a lot of things too that haven't come to fruition in the last 20 years. So.
He also said he's retiring at 60. So
yeah, I mean,
our number one trend of the year of the decade, not the year, the decade. I guess you guys can guess what this is, and it's not an involved text here. But 3D enters a new dimension. What was once a gimmicky fad is now widely accepted as the primary tool for the total immersive experience. Beyond the advancements in the technology itself, smart filmmakers have learned the proper way to utilize 3D. It's the depth more than the extreme foreground. How amazing is this technology? I think it could even add a whole two dimensions to a Michael Bay film. So,
wow.
So this is something, when I looked at the trends, I think this is going to be the most prominent trend going forward for a while, is 3D IMAX, the movie experience part of the movie.
I think it has the potential to kind of have the impact that color had. Like, I mean, it's a game changer. I mean, you really can imagine, as recently as a movie like Dark Knight, if that was shot in 3D, and not, again, not for a gimmicky reason, for an immersive type reason. Like, it immerses you in the world. Like, I mean, you have to hand it to James Cameron. He took this technology and took it to a completely different level. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think filmmakers are salivating over this, like, with what he did with it. The options, like, the possibilities are limitless with what you can do with that type of 3D.
Yeah. And it's true for the financial investment, but they wouldn't make money off of it unless people wanted to see it. So
right.
It's the audience too. I mean, you got to be honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
People want to be wowed when they go to the movies. 3D is a way to do that. But
obviously.
just because you're in 3D, you still got to make a good movie. I mean, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's the key thing. You just said you still have to have a great story and everything. If you don't have that, well, what do you have then?
Yeah. All right, so my top 10 trends. TV teaches movies a thing or two. The musical is reborn, but is the genre already singing its swan song? Mainstream audiences get a craving for porn, or at least the torturous kind. Raunch sells, especially when it comes from the heart. Professional critics are a dying breed. Is the independent spirit of the 90s dead or just mutating? Never forget 9/11, although in respect to the movies, sometimes we should. We've come a long way from Jar Jar. Digital is no longer just an indie's best friend, and 3D enters a new dimension. I think it's telling that the top three trends that I list, which, you know, this isn't gospel, but it's telling that they all deal with technology.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it's a great list.
It's an awesome list.
I think you put together a great list. Really, really, really well done.
Thank you, dude. And we finished 9 minutes early. You guys enjoy the Globes tonight? I'm hoping for a surprise. So, and 24 and all.
Last minute predictions. Come on. Last minute predictions. Best picture only.
Avatar
and, Julie and Julia, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah. Golden Globes will go for Avatar. Oscars will go for Hurt Locker. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick.
Disagree. Avatar all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Bridges.
And it deserves it.
Sandra Bullock. This will be your actor and actress tonight.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting.
You should come over and watch it with me, dude. I got a chicken casserole in the oven. How could you resist that, man? Come on.
Chicken casserole.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
Whatever, guys. Okay, thank you so much. It's been a great show, guys.
All right, good night.
It has.
Bye-bye, everyone.